Hey, this is Swoopy, and you're listening to Skepticality for Tuesday, June 10th, 2008. Beginning of the 20th century, about 5% of the doctors in the United States were women. In 1970, it was still only 7%. By 1998, 23% of all doctors were women. And today, women make up more than 50% of the medical student population. Our guest today on Skepticality was one of that 7%. When Dr. Harriet Hall graduated from medical school in 1970, she was only the second woman ever to do an Air Force internship, the only woman doctor at David Grant U.S. Air Force Medical Center, and the only female military doctor in Spain. Now a retired Air Force colonel, Dr. Hall writes about critical thinking and questionable medical practices, especially in alternative medicine. In addition to writing a regular column for Skeptic magazine as the SkepDoc, she is an editor of the Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine and a frequent contributor to Skeptical Inquirer and the Quackwatch website. Beginning this year, Dr. Hall began contributing a weekly column for the Science-Based Medicine blog, a joint effort of five skeptical MDs who are creating a valuable online resource for people investigating questionable practices in alternative as well as conventional medicine. I had the opportunity to talk with the SkepDoc herself about her recently self-published memoir, Women Aren't Supposed to Fly, that details the truth and often hilarious circumstances behind her unusual medical and Air Force career, and on her busy retirement as a prolific writer and investigator of pseudoscience. When did you know you were a skeptic?
You know, that would really be hard to say because it was a gradual process. I can remember believing in a lot of crazy things when I was younger, and it was just a matter of getting a chance to read something that explained it from another point of view, and I would change my mind. And gradually, I changed my mind about a lot of things. And it's not black and white. I think it's a gray gray line.
Well, but I think that's part of being a good skeptic is maybe not everything is absolute. You're free to question. If you look at the evidence, you don't just make a decision.
And I've always been willing to change my mind. I think that's what I like best about being a skeptic is learning. Because when you change your mind, it doesn't mean that you were bad before or that you were stupid for believing something that wasn't true. But when you change your mind, it makes you a better person. You know more. You're smarter.
I recently read your self-published memoir, Women Aren't Supposed to Fly. What made you decide it was time to write the story of your life so far?
Well, people had been telling me for years I ought to get some of my experiences down on paper, and I don't know, it just seemed like the time had come.
Well, even though you're retired from the military, you're still a very active person. You're doing lots of stuff. Do you think you'll write a sequel, like Memoirs of a SkepDoc?
You know, I told all my good stories in the first book. I don't know. I thought that it was important to get those experiences down because it was a unique point in history, and I had some unique experiences, and it has a lot to say about the women's movement and about the way things have changed in our country. And lots of people have become skeptics. I think my military story was a more unique story that needed telling.
Well, and it is a unique story. When you graduated from medical school in 1970, only 7% of America's doctors were women. You were an extremely rare female in a male-dominated role as a doctor and as an Air Force officer and a flight surgeon. How different is that role for women as a doctor and in the military today?
Well, it's been a while since I've been retired, so I can't speak from personal experience, but I know that at least half of students in medical schools today are women, and there are a lot more women in the military than there used to be. And I ran across a woman who happened to have done her residency in the same place that I did, And she's now working in the same hospital where I did my internship. And I asked her how things had changed, if she'd run across any problems being a woman in the military and in medicine. And she didn't even know what I was talking about. So I guess that's a good sign.
What were some of the challenges? There were many, and your memoir does detail a lot of them, especially, you know, in trying to get promoted. And how was it that you were a colonel and you only had two ribbons? And what were some of the biggest challenges you faced as being a minority of minorities in your position?
Oh, there were so many. I hardly know where to start. I think the hardest thing was probably during my internship, because I'd just graduated from medical school and I was still trying to convince myself that I was a doctor. Those two letters, MD, after my name were brand new. And you know, I'd been working towards it so long, and finally I was really a doctor. And then when people wouldn't accept me as a doctor, it kind of undermined my assurance in what I was doing. And I was only the second female intern in Air Force history. I was the first female doctor to work at the hospital where I did my internship in any capacity. And people would mistake me for a lab tech or a Red Cross volunteer or a nurse. And even when I'd tell them I was a doctor, they wouldn't hear it. And it got to be really frustrating.
How do you think your unique perspective of being a woman maybe made the way that you went about doing your job different than some of your contemporaries at the time? You mentioned that you were prone to listen to nurses where doctors wouldn't.
Yeah, I would read the nursing notes, and most doctors don't do that, but I learned all kinds of things from nursing notes. The nurses were less threatening to the patients and spent more time with them, and sometimes patients would tell them things that they wouldn't tell the doctors, or they'd forget to tell the doctors. And I wasn't afraid to ask the nurses questions. I didn't feel like I had to know it all. And for instance, on the pediatric rotation, if we'd admit a child who was, say, 2 years old, I didn't have children of my own at that time, and I wasn't sure what a two-year-old was supposed to be eating, and I had to write diet orders. And, you know, what am I supposed to tell a dietitian to feed this kid? I would just go to the nurses, and I'd say, what diet orders do the doctors usually write for two-year-olds? And they'd tell me. They were happy to be asked, and it didn't make me feel any less smart to ask somebody who knew more than I did.
Yeah, I think that is a big difference. My mom's an RN, and so I know her frustration sometimes with doctors, you know, thinking that nurses are, you know, just there to change a bedpan or be an orderly. And I think it's great to hear a different perspective from a doctor who realizes that they do spend more time with patients than doctors do, and they sure do have a lot of knowledge to contribute and experience.
And it's not a matter of who knows more and trying to be smarter than the next person. It's a matter of getting the job done and doing what's right for the patient.
While you're retired from the military, you're still a pilot?
Technically, I have a pilot's license, but I haven't flown in quite a while. I bought my own plane when I was in my residency training, and I learned to fly after I bought it. And I got my instrument rating and did quite a bit of flying before I had kids, but when two babies came along, I didn't have the time to keep current anymore.
Do you miss it?
Not really. I've gotten involved in so many other things. I've been so busy with my writing and had a lot of other interests that filled up my time, so I really don't miss it that much.
Well, that's good to know. Probably with the price of jet fuel, that it's probably better that you don't.
Yes.
So that brings us to talking about some of your writing. You are a regular contributor to many of the most notable skeptical publications, including Skeptic, Skeptical Inquirer, Quack Watch, and the Science-Based Medicine blog. How much time do you spend writing and researching these days?
Gee, that would be hard to say. It goes in spurts. Sometimes I'll get interested in something and spend hours reading and looking things up on the internet and writing. And other days, I just answer the questions on the health fraud discussion list on Quack Watch, and I read the comments of the blog. I'm very involved with the Science-Based Medicine blog right now, and we always have conversations going in the comments section, so that keeps me pretty busy, too.
When did you begin to take an interest in squashing medical myths and pseudoscience and quackery?
Well, that was way after I retired, and I really didn't know much about alternative medicine. I first started looking into it after I'd been to a Skeptics Toolbox workshop in Oregon, the one that PsyCop puts on, and I met Wally Sampson there. He's the editor-in-chief of the Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine. And he got me interested in looking into some things, but I think what really got me started was when I got an ad in the mail for vitamin O. There is no such thing as vitamin O, but they were selling a water that supposedly had oxygen in it, and you were supposed to take drops of this, just a tiny amount, and they said it would raise your oxygen level in your blood. And the company itself admitted that they'd had this vitamin O analyzed, and the lab couldn't find any oxygen in it. But that didn't stop them, because their theory was that it had so much oxygen in it that the laboratory instruments couldn't pick it up, which made me think, well, that's like saying if you pour a quart of coffee into your coffee cup, you end up with an empty cup. No, I don't think so. But anyway, they'd done this crazy indirect experiment to try to prove that there was oxygen in it and that it would raise your oxygen level in your blood. And I got a copy of the study, and it was the worst excuse for science that I'd ever read in my life. It was just absolutely putrid. So I called Wally Sampson, and I said, you won't believe this study. And he said, you know, nobody ever takes the time to really criticize those things properly. He says, why don't you write up everything that's wrong with it and why, and we'll publish it in the Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine. So I did that, and it was the first thing I think I'd ever written. And I didn't like doing it for the Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine, because you have to be all formal and scientific and proper, and I thought it was funny. So I wrote up a funny version and sent it into Skeptical Inquirer, and one thing led to another, and I've been going strong ever since.
And how did you become the Skeptoc for Skeptic Magazine?
Well, I had never met Michael Shermer until TAM3, and he was a speaker at TAM3, and during a break, I mustered up the courage to go up and speak to him. And I told him about a book I'd read that I thought would be a good one to have a book review in Skeptic Magazine. And he said, okay, write one. And I said, okay, and I did, and I sent him some other things, and he published everything I sent him, and then one day he emailed me and said, how would you like your own column?
You were mentioning that investigating this particular oxygenated water, and that nobody had investigated that before. Do you do that regularly now with a lot of the things that you review? I noticed you were talking about, which one was it? The Acavar.
And how, Acavar 2050, yes.
How many hoops you had to jump through to even get them to acknowledge you and to even send you the reviews that they said were cited, and they wanted you to sign a non-disclosure agreement and stuff like that. Talk a little bit about those kinds of outrageous hoops that, if anybody were to look into them, should set off all sorts of alarm bells.
Oh, that was a classic. You've probably seen the ads. I saw the ad for the first time in TV Guide. They say, we couldn't say it in print if it weren't true. And then they proceed to say things in print that aren't true. And they claim they had research that substantiated their claims. And I wrote and asked them for it. And I asked and asked and asked and asked. And when I finally got what they said was the basis for their claim in the advertising, it had nothing to do with their product. It was just, you know, absolutely inane. The problem with all of those ads, especially the weight loss ads, is they can say anything they want to until they get caught. And the FDA and the FTC can't possibly keep up with all of those false claims. And when they do get caught, all they get is a warning letter from the FDA saying you shouldn't make that claim anymore. And they say, oh, okay, we'll change our ads. And even if they do get in trouble, there have been cases where diet supplement companies were forced to pay retribution to their customers and things like that. They may have to pay out a lot of money in a settlement, but in the meantime, they've made gobs and gobs of money, and the people who made the money have moved it somewhere else so that the company can go bankrupt and it doesn't hurt them. And then they turn right around and they make another bogus product just as bad under a different name, set up a new company, and they're off and running again.
And do you find in researching this that weight loss drugs and quick weight loss treatments are one of the biggest offenders and one of the biggest areas of quackery that you see?
It's certainly a big one. I don't know that I would say it's the biggest quackery because it doesn't do the harm that some of the other kinds of quackery do.
That's a good point. You even mentioned, though, that you've had to deal with weight loss things back in your Air Force days, that you'd have a program for getting people who were, you know, over their weight limit back down. And it was a very simple formula to get people to lose weight. What was it?
Well, we actually used to put people in the hospital on an extremely low-calorie diet where we had to monitor them because it was not entirely safe, but sometimes it was the only thing that would work. But weight loss is really just mathematics. If you use up more calories than you take in, you lose weight, period. And every single diet, every single way of making people lose weight boils down to that one simple formula. And I used to have patients just keep a diet diary, and it's amazing because you don't realize how many calories are in some of the things you eat. And sometimes just being forced to write it down and estimate how many calories they were taking in would be all it took to make them aware of what they were eating and make them choose their foods more carefully. One of my patients was eating yogurt for lunch every day. And she thought that was a good diet food, and she had no idea how many calories were in it. It was right on the side of the carton, but she'd never looked. And she called me one day, and she said, "You know, I found out that stuff that I thought was a diet food, that, you know, there's 240 calories in every container of yogurt." And, yeah, I knew that, but I thought it was neat that instead of me having to tell her, she'd figured it out for herself and figured out that she needed to change her way of eating.
Well, and one of the problems is so many things are labeled natural, or now everything's being labeled organic or full fiber or things like that. The new thing is now to add fiber to everything. Is this just the similar type of making people think that what they're eating is good for them, even if it isn't?
Yeah, the funniest thing that I remember is when cholesterol was the big topic of conversation, all these products came out saying contains no cholesterol. And that included products that didn't contain any fat, that couldn't possibly contain cholesterol. They were making it look like they were giving you a better product to buy when it was something that, you know, cholesterol is only found in animal foods. So you'd get something like a vegetable product, and they'd say, contains no cholesterol. Well, of course it doesn't.
These carrots contain no cholesterol whatsoever.
Yeah.
Full of beta-carotene and cholesterol-free. Yeah, that's crazy. You were talking about what the FDA does and doesn't do for these kinds of claims, and I think one of the things that adds to the confusion in the general population about alternative medicine is that many people who endorse these things either are or claim to be doctors, touting some of these dangerous substances or therapies. Is there any active mechanism in the medical community or within the government that really does weed out the bad apples?
Not really. Of course, doctors can lose their license for harming patients, but it's hard to prove that a lot of these people are harming anybody because they're just giving advice. And you take somebody like Andrew Weil. He's a Harvard-trained MD. About half of what he says is good scientific medicine, and the other half is speculation. And he believes in all kinds of things. He believes in stoned thinking. He thinks your intuition is just as good as science for some things. And, you know, those people are more dangerous than the quacks because the public doesn't have any way of knowing how much of what they say is science and how much isn't. And they don't give you any clues. They present all that information as if it were equally valid. And yet you can't go take Dr. Weil's license away because he's practicing good medicine and he's doing things that people have different opinions about. I mean, he's not selling a laetril or anything bad. So I really think people like that do more harm than the out and out quacks.
He endorses a lot of products, and he has this kind of crunchy Santa Claus type aura that makes people trust him and thinks that he couldn't possibly be, you know, causing anybody any harm.
Yeah, I went on his website and took his nutrition quiz, and it said I should be taking, I forget now, something like $200 worth of vitamins and supplements a month that his website sells, of course. And as far as I'm concerned, from a medical standpoint, I didn't need a single thing on that list.
Well, and in general, are people taking too many vitamins and supplements compared to, you know, what they could be getting naturally in their regular diet? There seem to be so many vitamins now. The vitamin aisle at my grocery store is huge.
Yeah, and as far as what science tells us, it tells us that it's good for us to get all those vitamins and things in our diet. But every time they try to do a study where they add vitamins, especially the antioxidant studies that have been coming out recently, it looked like antioxidants would reduce the risk of heart attack. But when they gave people an antioxidant supplement, they had more heart attacks. And the research just seems more and more to be showing that if it's in your food, it's good. But if it's in a pill, it's likely to either make no difference or possibly even cause harm.
When I look at the back of some of these supplements, they say like one dose of this is like maybe 1,000 times the recommended daily value. I mean, isn't that dangerous too? I mean, I guess it depends on what it is, vitamin C or whatever, but...
Yes, I think every vitamin is poisonous in high enough doses. And vitamin A is a particular concern. You may have heard of polar explorers dying from eating polar bear liver. Polar bear liver is very high in vitamin A, and there were actually deaths among Arctic explorers. And the medical letter recently came out with an article on vitamins and supplements. They said that they don't recommend multivitamins for the general population, although there are some people who need vitamins for specific reasons, like if you're likely to get pregnant, you want to make sure you've got plenty of folic acid on board. And some elderly people may need extra vitamin D and vitamin B12, but only for specific reasons. And they particularly singled out vitamin A. They said that vitamin A, the amount of vitamin A that you find in the typical vitamin supplement, if you give it to postmenopausal women, it makes them more likely to have osteoporosis and fractures. So it's actually contraindicated for women after menopause, and it's hard to find a multivitamin that doesn't contain vitamin A. And then they mentioned beta-carotene, and they came right out and said no one should take beta-carotene in that form.
What about hormone replacement therapies? There's been a lot of controversy over those, whether they're safe or not.
Yes, I wrote an article on that for the Science-Based Medicine blog. The answers still aren't in. There have been a couple of good studies that showed that women are more likely to have heart attacks and breast cancer and certain diseases if they're on hormone replacement therapy. But at the same time, the hormones protected from colon cancer and a couple of other things, and there was no difference in death rate. That's something that was misreported in the media. They said women were dying from taking hormone replacement. They weren't. The death rate was exactly the same. They just were more likely to have things like breast cancer and heart attacks, but they didn't die from them. And more recent research, it's looking like if you take hormones around the time of menopause rather than in later years, it probably doesn't cause heart attacks in early menopause, and it may even protect against them in that age group. So we're still learning. We're groping our way.
Part of the problem, as you mentioned, the media reported, you know, something that was shockingly incorrect. There seems to be so many alarm bells ringing every day for either vitamin therapies or prescription drugs or things like that that somebody once was saying is the best thing ever, and then it turns around and it's harming people. Are the media partially to blame for putting out inconsistent messages regularly?
Science reporting leaves a lot to be desired. As a matter of fact, I've written an article that's going to go up on the blog tomorrow about mercury in dental amalgam fillings. And there was an article in my local newspaper that said the FDA has changed its mind about mercury fillings, and they're warning about them now. Well, I read what the government website said, and it bore no relation to what the newspaper said. I wrote an angry letter to the editor about that, and I ended up writing it up for the blog. And you can see the blog and see what the report said, what the study itself said, and what the American Dental Association said about it. And it's they just blew it all out of proportion.
Well, there were so many alarm bells going off about mercury all over the place in fish. You can't get a mercury thermometer anymore to save your life. I had to change our thermostat in our house, and it had mercury in it. And I was told that I should dispose of it via some specific mechanism. And I called my city office, and I called my recycling office, and nobody knew what I was talking about or had any way to recycle it.
Yeah. Well, there are instructions on the internet for cleaning up mercury spills in the home. You don't want to vacuum it. You don't want to do anything that'll aerosolize it. And mercury is poisonous, but in my generation, we all broke thermometers and played with the mercury and rolled little balls around. And it's such a small amount. It's not likely to do harm. That's the problem with all these toxin things, is that the poison is in the dose. One molecule of a poison never hurt anybody. And large enough amounts of anything can be poisonous, even water. So you got to put it in perspective.
I think that's one of the biggest problems, that the media tends to blow out of proportion and nobody reads the fine print. And so it's good that there are people who are looking into this stuff, like you and the folks on the Science-Based Medicine blog, so that maybe some people will get the story straight.
And that's something that everybody can do. This can be a grassroots effort. If you read something in your local paper that's not good science or that's contradicted by what the science blogs and other sources say, write a letter to the newspaper. If they get enough letters, they might learn to report better.
So in your mind right now, in your research, what are some of the most dangerous and pervasive, unproven therapies that are right now accepted by the general population as medicinally effective?
I haven't really thought about it in those terms as the most dangerous. I think of the silliest, the most illogical and unscientific, like homeopathy. That's got to win the prize for the most unscientific thing there is. But I don't think homeopathy does much harm because there's nothing in it but water. I mean, it's a very safe placebo that's effective for a lot of people. The real harm is when you believe the silly stuff and reject science, like people who have curable cancers, and instead of getting their cancer treated, they go to Mexico and take Laetrile and coffee enemas and all of the things they offer down there. And there's a website now called What's the Harm, where they look at a lot of different things, not just medical things, but things like believing in ghosts and other irrational beliefs. And they show the harm of people who have died from following crazy beliefs and people who've been harmed in all sorts of other ways.
So do you think that the rise of alternative therapies and the widespread use of homeopathic drugs, I mean, I still see Airborne on my store shelves, even after the lawsuits and things that happen. Is it due to the high cost of healthcare and prescription drugs, or is it people just not finding out what the truth is?
I think it's a combination. There are a lot of people that just don't trust the establishment. They don't trust medical doctors or the FDA or the government or big pharma. And they're looking for alternatives, and they're looking for answers where scientific medicine doesn't always have answers. The alternative medicine folks always have an answer. In fact, in one of my articles on the blog, I listed, I had about a 2-page list of things that people had said were the one cause of all disease. You go to a chiropractor and he'll find a subluxation and he'll say, that's why you're having problems. Let's fix it and then your body can heal itself. There's always an answer in alternative medicine. In scientific medicine, sometimes there's nothing better than a maybe.
I've experienced that firsthand because I have a significant leg length difference. And I don't know how many people, including some doctors, that told me that I should go to a chiropractor because they can, you know, they can fix that. I mean, really?
I still haven't figured out how chiropractic is going to lengthen the bone.
Oh, yeah. No, well, they're going to adjust my spine, I'm sure, so that leg will just magically grow an inch. You know, I don't know.
That's something I have written a lot about, and I've given talks on chiropractic. You can't entirely discount chiropractic because they do spinal manipulation techniques that are effective for certain kinds of mainly low back pain, musculoskeletal problems. The manipulation therapy is no better than any other therapy, but it is equivalent for getting quick relief in the early stages of back problems. And I think people ought to have access to that if they choose to do that. But doctors of osteopathy also offer it, and physical therapists offer it. And what scares me about chiropractors is if you go in for a musculoskeletal problem, you're likely to get hooked into some of the pseudoscientific things that they do, like maintenance adjustments for the rest of your life. And the really scary thing is that over half of chiropractors discourage immunizations, so they're endangering our public health.
Well, and I noticed that's the big story on the front of the Science-Based Medicine blog right now, was the recent rally by celebrities that are still trying to tell people not even to change vaccinations, but to eliminate vaccinating your children for fear of autism. That has just exploded recently.
Yeah, and now since the autism link has been pretty much disproven, now they're trying to say there are other toxins in the vaccines, and the problem is not the vaccines, it's the way they're given. I mean, they're out to get vaccines just on ideological reasons, and they're picking up all these pseudoscientific ideas to try to support their point of view.
The media continue to ring alarm bells about epidemics like obesity or type 2 diabetes, and now autism. What's feeding the rise of the autism epidemic? Do we even know if there are really more autistic children now, or do we just notice them more? What is the difference?
We're pretty sure there aren't more autistic children now. We're getting better at diagnosing them, and people who were diagnosed as other things are now being reclassified as autistic now that we're aware of that diagnostic category.
What are your thoughts about the rise of the internet and websites like WebMD that allow people to research their own symptoms? Do they create hypochondriacs or better informed patients?
We used to joke about that in medical school. As you go through medical school, you read about all these different diseases, and you think, oh, I might have that. Ooh, that sounds like something I might have. So, it creates a lot of false alarms, and it's hard to put things in perspective. I mean, you can read a list of symptoms, and some of them, you might say you have it or you don't have it, depending on your mood that day or how you want to define it. And lists of symptoms don't work nearly as well as a clinician with some experience listening to the symptoms and trying to put them in perspective and decide which ones are really important.
What are your thoughts about the high number of people, the high percentage of Americans without health care who don't have access to those kinds of tests, or the possibility that a new presidential administration might actually start working on a system of health care for everyone?
I try to stay out of politics. I'm very aware of the problem because I have two daughters now that have just finished college and are having to buy their own health insurance. And we were all shocked at how much it costs to get good coverage. And something needs to be done, but there are good arguments on all sides of what's best to do and the best way to accomplish getting health care to everyone. And I try to stay out of the arguments.
In one of your articles for Skeptical Inquirer about teaching pigs to sing, which I really enjoyed, you highlighted the feeling that many skeptics get about the frustrating disconnect between people who trust and rely on science and reason and those who seem to be from another planet. How do you deal with that kind of frustration?
I write articles for the Science-Based Medicine blog. Somebody recently said that the best thing about blogging was that it's a way for people to release their frustration.
Is that the best thing, though? I mean, especially, you know, being a blogger and the amount of give and take there is on the Science-Based Medicine blog between the contributors and the readers, there's no shortage of back and forth on a lot of emotionally charged issues. How do you keep cool in dealing with some of the people who want to learn or those who are annoyed that you're trying to teach them?
Well, it is really frustrating sometimes. I keep trying to bring the discussion back to the evidence, because most of the people that disagree with us are trying to say there is more than science. There are other ways of knowing, and you know, they get into mysticism and to things that are just unsupported beliefs. And all I can do is keep trying to bring them back to the facts. And sometimes it's a losing battle. I mean, if you're dealing with a true believer, there's not a thing you can say that will change their mind. In fact, the more you argue with them, the more they'll just find other reasons to justify their beliefs. But every now and then you have a success story. And I did have one on the Science-Based Medicine blog. I'd written an article about the cholesterol skeptics and how they picked up a few things that were true about cholesterol, but they'd gone completely overboard and thrown the baby out with the bathwater. And this guy in the comments kept attacking me really rather viciously, saying things like, you should read the book by Anthony Colpo. He puts you to shame. You don't know what you're talking about. And people kept telling him, oh, well, read this, read that. And he did. And he came back and he posted another comment. I've got a copy of it here. I'll read it. He said, Dr. Harriet, I sincerely apologize for insulting you. You are far smarter than Anthony Colpo. Anthony Colpo is just in it to sell books and is not qualified to interpret anything. I can see that now. He misrepresents, misinterprets, and takes out of context the data. I was stupid for listening to him without looking it up.
Wow, and he even said he was stupid. Not only did he tell you you were right, but he was stupid.
Yes.
That's impressive. Those are probably the moments that dealing with, you know, suffering all the other fools gladly to have that kind of breakthrough by somebody who listened to the facts and decided for themselves and then admitted that you were right, that must have been great.
Yeah, it doesn't happen very often, but I keep plugging away because even if you don't change someone's mind, sometimes you can plant a little seed of doubt, and then sometimes they'll read something else later that will add to that, and maybe years from now when they've forgotten all about me, maybe what I said will have helped to change their mind.
Well, in your columns and also on the Science-Based Medicine blog, you often review and dissect books ranging from bestsellers in the woo-woo genre to books defaming hucksters and snake oil salesmen and books about the medical field. So how do you choose which books you're going to read and review?
Various ways. I read reviews of them in the newspaper and magazines, or I hear about them online. Or one source I use is if I see a popular health book advertised in like the Book of the Month Club and various places, that something that I think a lot of people are reading, then sometimes I'll read that one just to see how much is science and how much is pseudoscience. I did one recently on the doctor that writes the women's menopause books. Her book was very popular, and a friend emailed me and he said, what do you think of this Christiane Northrup, because all my friends are reading her book and they're saying it's a wonderful book. What do you think? So I said, I don't know. I'll get it and I'll read it. And I read it and it was terrible. So I wrote it up on the Science-Based Medicine blog.
Living in the Pacific Northwest, which is quite different from where I live in the South, are there local booksellers that stock the kinds of books you're looking for in the fields of science and medicine? Because here I have to order just about everything, as the religious and new age sections of the bookstore take up a lot more real estate than books on science and medicine.
Oh, well, we have the chain bookstores, and they usually have a pretty good selection of the science books.
Oh, see, mine don't. They really don't. They have like a very tiny bit, and I'm lucky to find them, so I have to find most of myself online. So that's good to know. That's not everywhere.
As a matter of fact, when Michael Shermer was in town for his last book talk, my husband and I drove him around to several local bookstores so he could go in and sign books, and then this bookstore puts a sticker on it, signed by author, and they can sell it better. And we were surprised at how many of the several different titles that he's written were on the shelves.
Well, that must have been fun.
Mm-hmm.
What books are in your to-read pile right now?
My pile is not here right now. I have one that I got from the library, somebody's plan for longevity that I saw on a book club offering that I think is probably not very scientific, but I'm going to take a look.
Looks highly suspicious.
Yeah.
There seem to be a lot of books on longevity that's kind of a big thing right now. I guess it always is, the search for eternal and longer life.
Yeah, and I did a book review of three longevity books for Skeptic magazine a while back, and they make a lot of claims, but there's really no evidence that anything has ever made people live longer. The most promising thing is calorie restriction, but they're talking about severe calorie restriction that would be practically impossible for people to follow, and that they're just extrapolating from mouse and other mammal studies on that. So we really don't have any good proof that anything we do is actually going to make you live longer. It's all hypothetical.
I remember finding it really fascinating because I think it was Scientific American Frontiers was the one I was watching where they covered one of the main advocates of the severe calorie restriction, and we watched him eat these huge mounds of salad and stuff like that, and how old he was, but yet how fit he was. So it is interesting. So they're still researching that.
Well, yeah, they haven't. Nobody has done that long enough to know if they live longer. You need to have a lot of people do it for a long time to find out if it really works.
Yeah, it's an extremely long term study.
And then there's the unexpected consequences. Maybe it would make you live longer for certain reasons, but maybe if enough people do it, we'll find out that there are some real drawbacks and it's actually hurting people more than it's helping.
Are you going to be at the Amazing Meeting in Las Vegas later this month?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Are you scheduled to speak?
No. I put in a proposal, but I didn't get picked this year. Steve Novella will be there, and he can say it better than I can.
He's one of your cohorts on the Science-Based Medicine blog.
He's the one that set it all up. It's his baby.
It's an impressive list of folks that you have as writers on that blog. Very well-rounded group.
Yes, I feel very fortunate to be included in that elite company. I'd like to encourage everyone to read the Science-Based Medicine blog. There are archives going back to the 1st of January, and there are a lot of really good quality articles in there. A lot of people have discovered the blog and have gone back and read every single one from the first one on. And a lot of them are publishable quality articles. In fact, I think 4 of my blog articles now have been picked up for publication either in Skeptic Magazine or Skeptical Inquirer. So it's good stuff. If you enjoy the magazine, you should enjoy the website.
Well, and I think there's something there for everybody, whether you're looking to read out more information about clinical trials and things like that and resources for professionals, and then just for interested citizens who are trying to find out more about science and medicine.
Right. Some of the articles are a bit highbrow, but some of them address things that everybody wants to know, like, do mammograms really save lives? Is acupuncture for real? Should I detoxify? Will my cell phone cause brain cancer? Can magnets heal? We address some really interesting consumer questions.
Dr. Harriet Hall, is it Colonel Doctor or Dr. Colonel, or even though you're retired, how do you properly address someone who is a military officer and a doctor at the same time?
You have to pick one. I don't.
Oh, you can't put both together. I wondered. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
And I really do appreciate you giving me the time. And you said that your time for research and stuff like that varies, but even for a retired person, you sound like you're pretty busy.
There are not enough hours in the day. Both my husband and I, ever since we retired, we look back and we wonder how we ever found time to go to work.
Well, thank you for doing what you do and for alerting people to some of the dangers of all of the quackery that's out there. It's definitely needed.
Thank you, and I hope to see you at TAM6.
You absolutely will.
Want to stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.
You can read Dr. Harriet Hall's columns in the archives of the Science-Based Medicine blog, with new columns appearing each Tuesday. And you can find her work as contributing editor to Skeptic Magazine as the SkepDoc. Her memoir, Women Aren't Supposed to Fly, is available at Amazon.com and iUniverse, both in print and electronic form. If you are one of the lucky folks who will be traveling next week to the Amazing Meeting 6 in Las Vegas, hosted by the James Randi Educational Foundation, you may well meet the SkepDoc herself. I'm definitely looking forward to it. Shenanigans at the Amazing Meeting are most likely the topic of our next few Skepticalities, along with special guest interviews. So don't worry if you can't make it to Vegas. We'll fill you in on the goings-on from the Amazing Meeting, minus the hangovers or the heat stroke.
Join our discussion forums at www.skepticality.com. Leave feedback by email at feedback@skepticality.com or by phone at area code 206-888-HOAX. This has been Skepticality. Thanks for listening.